I hope that we'll all be together again here or somewhere else in the future. It's been a very interesting time. So, of course, I can't really define Gromov-Witten invariants. It would take more than an hour just to tell you what they are. So I'm going to have to be a little slippery in introducing what the conjecture is about. But let me have a crack at telling you enough and ask questions if something is completely unclear. So these are called the Gromov-Witten invariants by mathematicians now. And physicists call them, I guess, correlation functions of topological, 2D topological gravity. The reason being that they are defined by integrating over spaces of conformal structures on a Riemann surface. Just as gravity, quantum gravity, is expected to be integration over the metrics on a four-dimensional manifold. So there's this vague analogy between these invariants and the problem of quantum gravitation. So we start by introducing some moduli spaces. I'll be very vague on this point. These are moduli spaces of stable maps which go from some Riemann surface, compact and oriented, of genus G. Eventually they're allowed to become a little singular, but let's not worry about that today, with n distinct points marked on them, which is where we will do our experiments. And that should then have a stable map is in particular a holomorphic map. So no pseudo-holomorphic problem, because CP1 really is a complex manifold. And this should have degree D. So these moduli spaces, or stacks really, were defined through the work of Gromov and Konsevich and many other people. But they're probably the two central figures. Now on these spaces, which are pretty pathological, but I'll pretend that they're not, we have certain line bundles. So these line bundles so at such a stable map, the fiber is just given by the cotangent space of the curve at the ith marked point. So it looks as if it almost doesn't matter, depend on the map at all, but just on the domain. But because of the notion, the fact that our maps are stable, that gives a subtle interaction between the map and the line bundle, which sort of permeates the theory. So these are certain line bundles on these moduli spaces. They were defined by But they depend on all this data. But in a sense, the line doesn't depend on F, but, it doesn't use F in its definition, that's correct. So these line bundles were defined by Witten, and he introduced then the first Chern class of the line bundle, and it's these cohomology classes which will be very important to us. And we also have evaluation maps . This is just evaluation at the ith point. So using this data, we now define a collection of rational invariants. And the problem is to calculate them. So there, again, I will use Witten's notation, which is sort of incredibly convenient notation and incredibly incomprehensible to mathematicians. So let's see. Here, k1 up to kn are natural numbers. So actually, there's a sense in which this natural number has something to do with the equivariant cohomology of an action of the diffeomorphism group of the circle on the boundary circles of the Riemann surface. Now, there are no boundary circles. We just have, as it were, punctures. But the whole point of topological gravity is that it, you can think of it as being the, well, how do I say it? I think the way I like to think of it is that the state space for topological gravity is an equivariant cohomology space. And so you can think of this K as representing the different levels of equivariant cohomology of some circle. And I think a lot of Giffenthal's work has been very much making use of this analogy, which is somehow more than an analogy. And then the AIs lie in the set PQ. They are what are called the primaries, P and Q, the primary fields. And here, gamma sub P is 1 in the cohomology of CP1, while gamma sub Q is standard basis element of H2. So notice I'm actually doing something which we weren't taught to do as undergraduates, but which is very common these days. If we have a cohomology class on a space which is of a dimension different from the dimension of the space, you simply set it to 0. So I'm not going to bother to tell you what the dimension of the space is. Anyway, that's a subtle point, because this is a singular gadget. And really, the whole difficulty of the subject is to construct a certain so-called virtual fundamental class on it. And that was done by Ruan and Tian. So the problem is to calculate these rational numbers. And actually, currently, the answer is, as it were, not known. Although I think, as I will talk about in my talk, currently being written up is work which should, in some sense, give the answer to this. There is an algorithm to calculate them, which is due to Konsevich, and which was extended from genus 0 to higher genus by Graeber and Pandurpandur. So we can consider, if you need any particular one of these numbers, you can go and calculate it. But to calculate all of them by some systematic method, that's currently... well, the purpose of my talk is to explain to you a conjectural method of doing that. Okay, let's form all of these into generating functions. That will make it much easier to formulate the conjecture. So to do that, I introduce a bunch of new coordinates, or they're generating parameters, and it'll be convenient to use two different notations for them. So we have some sequence of parameters associated to the P primary and a sequence of parameters associated to the Q primary, and I'll also often call those S and T respectively. So we have now a space called the large phase space, which has all of these coordinates. And again, all of this formalism was introduced by Witten. So we then write down the genus G potential, and it's a sum over all degrees of some extra parameter Q, which I won't need to say very much about. And then we sum over all possible numbers of marked points, and then it's an exponential generating function. Then we sum over all possible Gremov-Witten invariants, and we have this generating function. So we throw in our coordinates, and finally our invariant. So here we have some very complicated generating functions with rational coefficients. And again, our goal is to calculate these. And in particular, we have, so we can form some vast generating function which contains all of them by introducing a new parameter, epsilon, and taking epsilon to the 2g, fg. This is slightly different from the usual conventions, which would multiply this by epsilon to the minus 2. But I have found this, well, it's maybe 6 of one and half a dozen of the other, which way you go, but I'll leave it like this. This epsilon will be a very important, play a very important role in this talk. Eventually, we're going to see that it's going to be a lattice spacing in a completely auxiliary problem, which will be quite different, have no apparent relationship to what we're discussing here. Now, S0, the genus 0 part, that is well understood by something called the topological recursion relations. And that solution of F0 was carried out by Dijkgraaf and Witten. And I'll now briefly tell you a little about what they got. Always very frightened to pronounce the names of Dutch mathematicians and physicists when there's a Dutch mathematician or physicist in the room. So they use two devices, the so-called topological recursion relations, these are also known, especially since the work of Giventhal, as the quantum differential equation. The other thing they use is the so-called string equation. So I don't have time to write any of those down, but they're well explained in the literature, especially in Witten's original paper, which is absolutely delightful to read. Now, to express a little of their results, I'll need to introduce some differential operators on the space which has these coordinates, the large phase space. So I will use dKa to denote the differentiation with respect to this coordinate tKa. And in particular, I'll have special cases. D is the case d0p, and dq is the case d0q. So these two vector fields with respect to the primaries play a very special role, especially this one. This primary p, if you go back to what it does at the level of Gromov-Witten invariance, you see that it has just a zero power of psi, which is 1, and also the pullback by the evaluation map of 1. So actually, we don't put a cohomology class at points which are labeled 0p. And that is called a puncture. It's as if we've just put the extra point in for the fun of it. And such points can be eliminated from the Gromov-Witten invariance by the string equation. So this operator is, if you do the counting, the unique, the unique irrelevant operator, and thus it plays a very special role. I'm not sure if I said that exactly right. Sorry? The unique relevant operator, thank you. It's the unique one with, negative degree in my language, but anyway. Okay. So now we introduce two coordinates, V and U. Now, where we're heading is to write down a different coordinate system on the large phase space, which makes the structure clearer. That was the idea of Dijkgraaf and Witten. So the first of these coordinates is, they're both given by second partial derivatives of F0. It's the crossed differential, and the second one is the second differential with respect to the puncture coordinate. Now, using the string equation, we can actually see that these are given by S0 plus some higher order terms, and t0 plus some higher order terms. So that's very good. We've already captured the first pair of coordinates on the large phase space. And if you take partial derivatives of these coordinates, you see that the pattern actually continues as nicely as you might hope, except for this funny one here, which is because of a peculiarity in the string equation. This one, in some sense, represents the fact that the Deligne-Mumford-Knudsen moduli space M02 bar doesn't exist. That's sort of, from a mathematician's point of view, where that one comes from. And similarly, on the U side, we have that for n greater than 0. So actually, you see that these coordinates are a coordinate system on the large phase space, although we've had a shift of the origin. And these coordinates are nothing but the coordinates on a jet space, the jet space of the space with these two coordinates. So this allows us to identify the large phase space with the jet space of formal arcs in the space with coordinates U and V. Okay. And let's see. This, incidentally, if you ever read the work of Dubrovin, he extends this to the case of any Frobenius manifold. What we're studying here is a very simple example of a Frobenius manifold. And he calls these formal arcs loops, which prevented me from understanding his work for some time. I guess they're an applied mathematician's loop. Yes, sorry. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, of course. Can I erase the upper board? You will not lose track of where we are if I erase the definition of Gromov-Witten invariance. Now, I'm going to skip all the details, but if you now use some basic results of Dijkgraaf and Witten, which basically say that all second partial derivatives of F0 are just functions of U and V. Or maybe I can even say that. These second derivatives of F0 just depend on, they're just functions on this two-dimensional space. They don't ever involve the jet coordinates. This result, incidentally, I've recently extended it in work with Eguchi and Xiong, and there's an analog of this for any genus and for any Frobenius manifold, that FG is a function on some finite jet space. But let's stick to genus 0 for now. And then just using this alone, plus the fact that we know the quantum cohomology of CP1, we get the following equation. So that's a beautiful equation. And that is, in fact, the Toda equation. So here we are already in the right. territory. So let me introduce the Toda hierarchy in this limit. This is not exactly the Toda equation. This is the so-called dispersionless limit of the Toda equation, where one works with lax operators and a Poisson bracket and not a commutator. So let me introduce that dispersionless limit of the Toda equation and explain how this equation comes from it and how then it was conjectured by Iguchi and Yang, proved by Iguchi and Yang that the higher Q derivatives also in the dispersionless limit come from the Toda hierarchy. So our goal here is to describe the vector fields, the action of the vector fields, of these vector fields. These are commuting vector fields. On the large phase space, and they also commute with this derivative operator. And now if we take the large phase space and think of it as the jet space, our goal is actually very simply expressed. How do we write these vector fields in terms of the coordinates u and v? This is the problem of the theory of integrable hierarchies. We have a jet space, and we want to describe infinite families of commuting vector fields on that jet space. And there's a lot understood about it now, ever since the seminal work on the KdV hierarchy in the 60s by the many authors. So I take you on a little detour now. If you've never seen lax operators, it's going to be a bit of a shock. But let's have a crack at it. So let's just give a simple example of an integrable hierarchy. I'm going to give it in a very abstract formalism. The original work worked with actual matrices in GL infinity or even in finite dimensional matrix algebras. And this is lurking here are links to quantum groups, which I'm not going to make apparent. So I introduce a differential algebra. Actually, I have to also take power series in little q, but that won't affect what we're doing very much. And then I take this differential algebra. You can see that if this has a differential, which you define on these guys by the obvious method, and also d of e to the u is e to the u du, so it extends to the whole algebra. And we take a Poisson bracket on it. Not on this algebra, sorry, but on Laurent polynomials in a momentum variable p. This is a momentum variable corresponding to our variable s0 as the time variable. So the Poisson bracket is given by this formula. Now the key thing that allows us to define, well, there are two elements in defining the integrable hierarchy. The first element is a projection operator. So this projection takes us from Laurent polynomials to, sorry, Laurent polynomials to ordinary polynomials. The key point is it projects out all of the negative powers. And this is a Lie subalgebra of this Lie algebra. And so we actually are moving into the area of Malian triples, which is the link with quantum groups. And the second element is a Lax operator, or a Lax function here, because we're just in a Poisson algebra, L, which is P plus V plus e to the u P inverse. Okay. And now I can... Now I can state the Lax equations. These define, the first time you see them, it's a bit confusing. These define, oh yeah. Well, I'm sorry, I meant n greater than or equal to zero. Yeah. So there was, I'm being a bit slipshod, n greater than or equal to zero. So d0 is. So this is a bit confusing. We write down the following equation. So we take L, we take the nth power of L, and take only its polynomial part. This is some Laurent polynomial, throw away the negative powers of P. Take the Poisson bracket and declare this to be the action of the nth flow on L. So actually, people who work in integrable hierarchies think of the Lax operator flowing. But we can simply interpret this as the V and U flowing. And let's see how that comes about. Suppose delta N was, in fact, a derivation of A. Then, and we assume that it kind of acts trivially on P. Then this would equal delta N V plus e to the U delta N U P inverse. Well, it turns out that this Poisson bracket really does have this form. So it defines a pair of functions, delta nv and delta nu. And we now define I'll leave that as an exercise for you. And we now define a derivation of A, if you want a vector field. On the jet space, by the following: delta n of dkv equals dk of delta nv, where delta nv is simply the p to the zero coefficient of this Poisson bracket, and delta n of dku equals dk delta nu. Now, I've enforced by this definition that these vector fields all commute with our basic vector field del. But something more dramatic happens. These vector fields, these derivations, are all commuting with each other. And that's exactly what we were looking for. It's an exercise in understanding the role of this plus projection. Basically, the fact that the complementary projection also defines a Lie subalgebra. So we have a pair of complementary Lie subalgebras, and a little manipulation then ends up showing that these guys commute. So it's a very beautiful technique. Very special, admittedly. I define delta n of e to the u. Is that the word you want? But I'm working with polynomials in my generators. And therefore, that's why I threw e to the u in. I didn't want to work with holomorphic functions. Well, I'm taking a very special collection of functions, somehow. The jet space is in the back of my mind, but in practice I want to work algebraically because I can prove stronger theorems than you might imagine from the jet space formalism. I can prove, so I've just borrowed this formalism straight out of a paper that I've recently written, where I want to show at every stage that all the functions I deal with lie in this algebra A. And so, what? Oh, they're defined by this equation. I read off by definition. Delta N of V is the P to the zero coefficient of this Poisson bracket, and delta N of U is E to the minus U times the P inverse coefficient of this Poisson bracket. And then, yeah, absolutely. I mean, you can write a Maple program in a couple of minutes, which will give them all to you. It won't be able to prove for you that they commute. For that, you need to be a mathematician, or a physicist, or something. Now, I've got to say that, you know, I've been seeing these Lax equations for years, and I never really understood them. So I'm slowly... It's like all really amazing formalisms. Eventually, you realize that it's what you see is what you get. There's nothing behind the curtain. And this is just a very beautiful way to do exactly what it states, namely construct commuting vector fields on jet spaces which are translation invariant. Okay. So here's the conjecture, well, the theorem, actually. Okay, so now comes the key idea, which is to promote this to a formula valid in all genera. And that's what the Toda conjecture is. So this comes again from the same paper of Iguchi and Yang. This is the Toda, dispersionless Toda hierarchy. Yeah. Maybe I should have worked out the first one. I actually wrote that down in my notes. You can find in their paper many calculations of Toda flows. Let's see if we can do this. So N equals 1. So here, L plus is just P plus V. So we have to calculate P plus V, Poisson bracket P plus V plus E to the U. But this is a Lie bracket, so P plus V bracket P plus U, P plus V bracket P plus V is zero. And therefore, this is just equal to P plus V bracket E to the U. P inverse, thank you. And we quickly calculate this to equal d of e to the u plus e to the u dv p inverse. And in that way, we see that delta 1 of v is d of e to the u, and delta 1 of u is d of v. And in particular, delta 1 squared of u is d squared, the Laplacian of e to the u. If you integrate this equation twice, you get the Toda equation. You recall that u is the second derivative of f0. So that's where the Toda equation comes from, and it's what leads to the guess that the Toda hierarchy is relevant here. And once you've checked that it works in genus zero, it's natural to take, as it were, off the shelf, the Toda hierarchy in all its complexity, and guess that that is going to be the description of these vector fields on the jet spaces in general. So I'm leaving out a lot from the paper of Iguchi and Yang that I'm not talking about matrix models, there are other flows and so on. I'm just presenting you with a part of the story here. So I recommend looking at their paper for other ideas which haven't yet really been explored. Okay. So actually, as it happens, this conjecture seems to have recently been proved. I haven't stated the conjecture yet, but let me state. So there, they believe they've proved it, but they haven't written it up, so they're not complete 100% confident, but they're pretty sure that it'll work. And it's very interesting how they approach it. From a mathematician's point of view, they reduce these Gromov-Witten invariants to Hurwitz numbers. And then, those of you who know a little about integral hierarchies can then well believe that to Hurwitz numbers, which have a lot to do with representations of symmetric groups, might be related to vertex operators, and in fact, they're ultimately able to find a tau function. So in that way, prove that they have a solution of the Toda hierarchy. So that's for people who already know what the Toda hierarchy is. And for those of you who aren't quite sure what Hurwitz numbers are, but are physicists, then I believe this is the same thing as 2D quantum chromodynamics or something. There was a little burst of activity in that a few years ago. So it could be that their proof will be rewarding for physicists to study also. Okay, now let's try to state the Toda hierarchy. So now I need a couple of operators. So first I have a finite difference operator, which I will take in a symmetrized form. And so this, of course, begins with ordinary differentiation, but has many higher order terms. Maybe I should state an example. Epsilon squared del cubed over, oh God, I've worked this out many times, 24, and then higher ones. So the first trick is to replace the operator del, which occurs in the dispersionless theory, by this operator Nabla, which is a finite difference operator for a lattice spacing of epsilon. Why the lattice spacing should be the square root of the genus parameter is a great mystery to me. It'll also be convenient to have a lattice shift operator, which is just shifting by epsilon along the line. So these are all formal operators. It's a good thing that we're working over a formal power series in epsilon, or these wouldn't be defined on the jet space. But maybe at this point, oh, okay. No. Now, I have to change the definition of A a little by allowing power series in epsilon. And then I now have a product on an algebra. This algebra is somehow very similar to the algebra of infinite general linear Lie algebra, infinite matrices. Somehow lambda corresponds, the power of lambda corresponds to which diagonal you're working with. So A is like diagonal matrices from commutative algebra, and the powers of lambda tell you how to move the diagonal matrices above and below the diagonal. But let me not say any more about that. most everything else stays much the same. The key problem is how to modify the definition, go from Poisson bracket to product. Somehow the whole trick in the subject is to guess which associative algebra we're working with. Once we have the associative algebra and the projection, the rest is gravy. So I'm going to work with a particular definition, which, again, I find very convenient because it's very symmetric, although it looks a little unfamiliar at first, and it's the following. And you can check that this defines... You can check that this defines an associative algebra. So the powers of lambda add, and then we shift A and B a little up and down the line before multiplying them. So it's actually some kind of cross product algebra. K plus L. It's some kind of cross product algebra. And then the lax operator is essentially the same. In fact, most everything is almost the same. The lax equation becomes this. And this, as epsilon goes to zero, this really converges to the previous lax equation. So we have found a quantum deformation of the dispersionless lax equation. And that, in some sense, is what the genus expansion problem is in Gromov-Witten theory. How to deform a well-understood integrable hierarchy in the genus zero limit to a full hierarchy. The theorem remains the same. We can define now here through this same technique, we again define flows, which now are power series in epsilon. And the epsilon goes to zero limit is the original vector field. But they still commute. They still are translation invariant. It comes in. Basically, what happens now is the first flow, for example, changes only by the replacement. The higher ones, it's a bit more complicated. But the very first one, you simply replace differentiation by Nadler. That's it. So you can explicitly see how it's a deformation of the original flow. And now the Toda equation just becomes, you replace del by Nadler squared. What is Nadler squared? So it's d squared plus epsilon squared over 12 d to the fourth plus dot, dot, dot. No, it's just in the background as an expansion parameter. So here you can say, now we've got some genus 1 stuff going. Because epsilon squared is governing genus 1 behavior. And somehow the Toda conjecture is saying that everything... that we don't have to, that the only thing which we need to understand in order to go to higher genera for CP1 in studying their Gromov-Witten invariants is this idea of replacing the dispersionless Toda hierarchy by the full Toda hierarchy. That is, placing this Poisson algebra by an associative algebra, which is somehow its deformation quantization. Okay. So, I forgot something really important, though. There's one other change which is essential here, which is that V is Nabla of dQ of F, and U is Nabla squared of F. So I change the definition of the coordinates by also perturbing them in epsilon. On the other hand, this is still S0 plus higher order terms, and this is still T0. So it's only in powers of epsilon that anything has changed. I apologize for leaving that out. That's the key idea, to correctly change the coordinates and to correctly quantize the algebra. That's the two parts in understanding the CP1 in brains. Incidentally, this is a very strange history to these coordinates, because in the original Eguchi-Yang paper, there was a... Well, they had missed... There's a degree zero Gromov-Witten invariant in genus 1, which they had missed. And so they actually found a beautiful solution to the problem with different coordinates, which solved the genus 1 problem. But once the genus 1 problem was correctly written down, one had to change to these coordinates. It doesn't really... there's no real way to predict what the identification of the coordinates is going to be. So that's the only part of the problem, which is somehow you have to go back to the Gromov-Witten invariants to work out which is the correct fit. But once you've got the fit at genus 1, it's pretty much forced at all genera. So then the conjecture becomes... Well, the Toda equation hardly changes. The only change is it's true now with the modified notion of U, it's true in all genera. This is an incredibly powerful equation. In particular, if you know the degree zero Gromov-Witten invariants, what do physicists... the large volume limit, then this equation determines all of them. Okay? And I'll leave you the fun of... which is not really very much fun, of writing out some more flows in this Toda hierarchy. There, it really gets quite messy. It's... the Toda conjecture is the same as before. Sorry. So actually, because of the string equation, this is implied by the n equals 1 case of this. And this conjecture is what seems to have been at least... part of, I should say, they haven't quite proved it. I'll get to that later. It turns out you need the Virasoro conjecture to finish the proof. So modulo the proof of the Virasoro conjecture, which also seems to have been proved recently, it looks like. It almost determines it. This equation, which is already a part of the... this... I'll say a little more about that in the rest of my talk now. This conjecture does not determine F, but it comes very close, and I'll explain now how close. Oh, so I'm halfway through my lecture. So let me give another form of the conjecture, which I found last year, and I've finished a preprint which will be available quite soon. Equivalent form of the conjecture. We introduce a differential operator, which is V times Nabla plus e to the half plus e to the minus a half. Remember, these are left shift by epsilon over 2 and right shift by epsilon over 2 times dq. This is a recursion operator, and we can now write down the following form of the conjecture. I don't have time to explain where this comes from. Essentially, you can view this... this, in some sense, comes from a lengthy manipulation of the Lax equation, which is due to Cooper-Schmidt. But another way of saying it is this reflects something called the bi-Hamiltonian nature of the Toda hierarchy.
I have a question about the latter. Of the three,
yeah.
Classically, the two of them, depending on Gromov-Witten, where are they coming from?
In this one?
No, in the Toda conjecture.
in here, this somehow. Because the formulas for these involve Gromov Whitney invariants. They're explicit formulas for vector fields using U and V. Therefore, you need to know the Gromov Whitney invariants to write these down. Actually, so the logic is a bit more confusing than I'm explaining. If you assume the Toda conjecture, the Toda equation, then this box is equivalent to this box. That's what I actually prove. And this is somehow a very down-to-earth and convenient form for the conjecture. If you look at all of this conjecture, I maybe should have mentioned, is somehow inspired by a conjecture of Witten, which was proved by Konsevich, that if you replace CP1 by a point and just look at pure topological gravity, then you have the KdV hierarchy. And there's an analogous recursion, which is very famous. It involves third derivatives. This, however, well, it involves first-order difference operators. It's a much simpler recursion, I believe, in some sense. Somehow, there's two coordinates, which makes things a little more complicated, but in many ways, the Toda conjecture is formally simpler than the KdV conjecture. Okay. So this equation is very powerful. For example, it determines, roughly speaking, half of the degree zero Gromov Whitney invariants of CP1. So if you take the limit as Q goes to zero, then what you get is it calculates these numbers. This is just, there's no stable maps anymore. These are just ordinary Deligne, Mumford, Knudsen moduli spaces, which are orbifolds, compact orbifolds, and we have just an integral of characteristic classes on them. These are the Hodge classes introduced by Mumford. So these numbers, as it happens, they've been calculated by Faber and Pandrieu-Pandrieu, but this recursion predicts the answer that they got in a very simple fashion. I actually wrote out the details, but I guess they'll go on the web. Let me just mention the outcome, which follows just in a few lines from this equation, that if you form the generating function of integrals like this, then this is simply epsilon over 2 over sinh epsilon over 2. So a very beautiful result, which was proved by Faber and Pandrieu-Pandrieu. And it's somehow not so easy to see how to get this directly from the Toda conjecture, although it must be implied by it, because it's directly implied by this recursion. So that gives you just one example of the power of the recursion. So, well, the rest of my talk, is about the problem of describing the remaining flows. So I've left completely aside in this talk a discussion of the flows DNP. There's one of these flows that we understand very well, this one, the original derivative. We have a formula for that. It's almost it's just what we've used to set up the formalism. But the remaining flows commute with each other. They commute with the Q flows. They must exist. And Eguchi and Yang gave a conjecture for how to construct them, which I have not been able to make any head or tail of, unfortunately. It involves taking the logarithm of the Lax operator, and it just seemed too difficult as a technique for proving that flows commute. But I've been able to construct these flows explicitly using the methods of integrable hierarchies, especially the techniques of Magri, and Gelfand and Dorfman by Hamiltonian hierarchies. So all of this is material going back to the 70s, which allows you to construct commuting flows on jet spaces. So I don't know the formulas for these flows, though. I can prove they exist. I actually use obstruction theory to prove they exist. I wasn't able to do any better. So you set up a cohomology problem, and then it, step by step, you show that the flows exist. I'm very pleased with this result because it's, to my mind, the most non-trivial application of the methods of Gelfand and Dorfman. I think most of their methods were either reproducing results for lax operators or studying what I would think of as relatively artificial systems. This is a very, this is definitely not an artificial system, but their methods work very beautifully here. So, to give a little taste of what happens, or how I came to understand these . Let me write out another recursion relation. So here's a recursion relation. It might or might not be true, let's say. Then the fact is that in the presence of the Toda conjecture, this relation is equivalent to the Virasoro conjecture. So that's my second main result. So assume the Toda conjecture in the form that I've stated it, then this is equivalent to the Virasoro conjecture for CP1, which again has recently been proved by Giventhal. So we're in a very good situation now. And not only that, but Okunkov and Pandrepande did not in fact prove the full Toda conjecture. They only prove it on an infinite dimensional submanifold of the large phase space where the higher S's vanish. And using these results, you can actually propagate their Toda conjecture to the full large phase space and thus see that if the Virasoro conjecture holds, then their result implies the Toda conjecture. So you really need the full bi-Hamiltonian technique, the construction of all of these flows that I announced, in order to extend their work to the full large phase space. So, in conclusion, well, it's not quite conclusion, I want to squeeze in a few more ideas before the end of the talk. So, what's the story? I want to give a tiny taste of how I proved this equivalence, because the proof is actually just essentially one line, although it's a very long line, so it ends up taking three lines in the paper. The idea is basically to prove a recursion for the Virasoro constraints. These Virasoro constraints gets a bit confusing now because I should have said this Virasoro conjecture comes from the sequel to the Iguchi Yang paper, which is by Iguchi, Hori, and Yang. They discovered that, I think, or is it in your original paper? I forget. I think it's in the sequel, and they discovered that the matrix representation that had been discovered in the Iguchi Yang paper implied the existence of certain vector fields, differential operators on the large phase space, which are conjectured to annihilate this function. Sorry, no minus sign. So now those differential operators are called L sub n, have nothing to do with the lax operator, and these constraints Z sub n are just my notation for this gadget. So this will vanish if the Virasoro conjecture holds. And what I prove is some complex, a rather complicated equation. This is a function. Well, let me say first, it's equal to the sum from 0 to infinity of m plus 1, m plus k, sm tilde, where times, let me call this constraint y sub n minus 1, the left-hand side minus the right-hand side. Times y m plus k, where sm tilde, bad notation, x, where sm tilde is sm for m not equal to 1 and s1 minus 1 for m equal to 1. This is this thing which keeps on cropping up in studying the string equation and so forth, plus some function, k should be n, plus some function of the y's. So if the y's vanish by the Toda conjecture, then we just get an invertible matrix. The vanishing of these constraints is equivalent to the vanishing of the Virasoro constraints, because we know that z minus 1 vanishes. That's the string equation. So that's the structure of the analysis. And I don't have time to talk about the work that I've been doing with Rahul this week. In fact, where we have a new approach to understanding the P descendants, basically by going to something called the Toda field theory, which has two lax operators, which are... So instead of just having one time, you have two times. And then, from the point of view of Gromov-Witten invariants, essentially, you're shifting perspective from Q and P to the equivariant cohomology of CP1 with a circle action, which is spanned by the cohomology classes, equivariant cohomology classes corresponding to the two fixed points. It turns out that using that basis for the cohomology clarifies all of the things that I've discussed enormously. But those links have yet to be found, so maybe it's a good thing that I don't have time to talk about it. So thank you.